Welcome to All Together Now. This week, the third National Climate Assessment was published in Washington and also online at globalchange.gov, which is a really interesting website. You should take a look. globalchange.gov. This monitoring and reporting process was set in motion by an act passed by Congress back in 1990, and the first assessment was published in 2000. We would have had more than three assessments by now, as the law intended, except that the Bush-Cheney administration pulled the plug on the entire mandated process while they were in power. The second assessment was not published until 2009, and the current assessment presents the scientific documentation, very easy to follow charts, documenting what I would think everyone has noticed anecdotally concerning our arrival into the era of extreme weather events and periods like the long droughts. One example is the increased levels of extremely heavy rainfall in the eastern half of the country. Between 1958 and 2012, the amount of precipitation falling in what the assessment calls heavy events, which we would call rainstorms, increased by 71% in New England, by 37% in the Midwest, and by 27% in the South. Also, the rising sea levels from the melting polar ice caps have begun to inundate coastal towns and cities. And a different but related problem is that greenhouse gases in the atmosphere are drying out the Southwest and the agricultural Central Valley of California, which supplies a lot of the vegetables for the United States. There, and also on the Great Plains, the moisture level in the soil is dropping significantly, not only because of extended drought, but also from evaporation because of the higher temperatures, which will be at least 10 degrees higher by the end of the century if we stick to the status quo regarding our level of carbon dioxide emissions. So, as the respected climate blogger Joe Rahm, and this guy has a PhD in physics from MIT, as he stated, quote, "The choice should be easy, given that other research paints the same grim picture, not just for the Southwest and the Great Plains, but for multiple regions around the globe. And we know that if we do dust bowlify a third of the planet's land, it will be irreversible for 1,000 years. Does it really seem like a good trade-off to destroy our livable climate and our food security just to avoid a cost that the world's leading scientists and governments agree is a mere 0.06% of annual growth," unquote. He adds that what the assessment calls the B1 scenario, which entails cutting our level of carbon emissions now to stave off increasingly extreme damage, resulting in uninhabitable conditions in many parts of our country, this B1 scenario to hold the line at only a slight increase of the crisis will be all but closed off to us within another decade of inaction. Now, you may have heard about the unbelievable response to the National Climate Assessment made by three Republican leaders in Congress a couple of days ago. One of them said, oh, that climate assessment, it's just a diversion. Obama's talking about it. It's just a diversion to deflect attention away from the problem at the VA hospital in Phoenix. And another one said, oh, the climate assessment, Obama's just talking about it because he's captive to his big donors, and they like to talk about climate change. And then the third one, the three appeared together, like a kind of, you know, video press release. Third one said, anyway, the American people don't care about climate change. Well, on that last point, he is apparently horrendously correct, because that was the conclusion of the 2014 annual survey conducted by the Gallup organization on March 6th through 9th, entitled Americans Worry About National Problems. And in this survey, they show people a list of 15 issue areas every year, and they ask whether they worry about each one a great deal, a fair amount, or little or not at all. And remarkably, this was the first year that Gallup included climate change on the list of subjects that people might be worried about. What they found was that only 24% of Americans say they worry a great deal about climate change. This puts climate change, along with what they called the quality of the environment, near the bottom of the list of 15 issues Americans rated in the Gallup survey. The economy, federal spending, health care, and, quote, the size and power of the federal government, unquote, dominate Americans' worries at the top, in the top five of the list. The only issue on the list that Americans are less worried about than climate change is race relations. The majority of Americans say they worry about these two issues only a little or not at all. In contrast, more than half of Americans worry about the other 13 issues at least a fair amount. So, to review, at the bottom of the list of 15 issues about which Americans might be concerned is race relations. Second from the bottom is climate change. Third from the bottom is the quality of the environment. I just saw this morning that on Fox News, Charles Krauthammer said climate change yesterday. He said this, climate change is a superstition, like a Native American rain dance. And regarding concern about the environment, only 31% of Americans in that survey indicated that they worry a great deal about it this year, which is the lowest level of concern about the environment since Gallup began including it in this annual survey in 2001. During that time, the Americans' concern about the environment peaked in 2007, when 43% worried a great deal about its condition. So, if you have not yet grasped how hideously successful the campaign by the energy corporations and the Koch brothers and their whole network of fellow scoundrels has been with their propaganda campaign, this 2014 Gallup survey of what Americans are and are not worried about presents the hair-raising evidence. The network of people orchestrating this extreme shift to the right, who will do nothing about global climate disruption, are now well positioned to score big in the midterm elections in November, and also to take control of both Congress and the White House 2 years from now. Imagine having the federal government controlled again when the situation is even far worse than during the Bush-Cheney years by people who say, oh, we don't want to talk about global climate disruption. The American people don't find that important. So, where is the Democratic Party in effectively countering this campaign of disinformation, which has been going on for decades? They're tragically ineffective. And really, I have to wonder if even the Gallup organization itself has not become influenced by the corporate sector's campaign. Because one of their entries on the list, the way they phrase this issue is, the availability and affordability of energy. I mean, was that written by the fracking lobby or what? Solar panels, photovoltaic cells, the price of them has dropped 75% in recent years. If you're worried about affordability, get those on the roof of every house and get people off the utility company's bills. And, of course, there would have to be local distribution systems of people sending the electricity out. It would be decentralized. It would be so much safer than what we've got. and it would be plenty available. And then, what I found really amazing, there's no entry whatsoever about the damage to our lives, including all the birth defects and learning disabilities caused by pollution and toxic chemicals in the air and the soil, water, plastic containers, and in our food. Environmental toxins are not even an entry on the Gallup list of things Americans might be worried about. One more big issue that was not on the Gallup list is the 17,300 nuclear warheads worldwide that are currently functional and ready to go. At least one of those nuclear weapons has almost been launched on 5 occasions in recent decades, when a government erroneously thought for a bit that it was under attack. Now, on the day that I was last with you, 2 weeks ago, April 24th, the island nation of the Republic of the Marshall Islands filed 2 lawsuits against the United States and the 8 other nuclear weapons states for failing to meet their treaty obligations under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty of 1970, which stipulates that all the signatories are to negotiate in good faith for complete nuclear disarmament. One of these suits was filed at the UN's International Court of Justice in The Hague, and the other was filed in a U.S. federal district court. We'll hear more about this development now from my guest. My guest today is Robert F. Dodge, M.D. He's a member of Physicians for Social Responsibility, and he's a family physician in Ventura, California, where he serves on the board of the Los Angeles chapter of Physicians for Social Responsibility. He also serves as a peace and security ambassador at the national level of that organization, where he sits on the security committee. And he's on the board of Nuclear Age Peace Foundation and Citizens for Peaceful Resolutions. Robert Dodge writes on issues related to war and peace with a focus on nuclear war and the health consequences of nuclear war. He also writes on health effects of climate change and national health policy, emphasizing the interconnections among these issues. His articles and opinion pieces appear in Peace Voice and Common Dreams. Robert Dodge, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Well, I'd like to begin by asking you about this lawsuit that the Republic of the Marshall Islands has filed and its significance, because I think most people don't realize that the 50,000 nuclear warheads in the early 1980s, I think we had 30,000 pointed at the Soviet Union, they had 20,000 pointed toward us, that has not been reduced to a very few, but to more than 17,000. So tell us about this lawsuit.
Okay, well, this is a remarkable landmark case that, again, the tiny island nation of the Republic of the Marshall Islands brought, as you said, on April 24th. This has been a couple of years in the making, but it's a real David versus Goliath situation. Here, this tiny island nation, which is a non-nuclear state, but is also one of the 190 nations signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, has finally stepped up on behalf of really the 7 billion of us who live on the planet to say enough is enough. The nuclear states, again, of which you said the United States and certainly Russia hold probably 96 to 97% of the world's stockpiles, have not met their obligation and have breached the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which says we must be working in good faith to abolish, not reduce, but abolish nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
The Marshall Islands was the site, you know, during between 1946 and 1958 of much of the U.S. Testing of nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
We exploded about 67 major nuclear blasts there, including the famous Bikini Atoll that people are familiar with, the graphic image there in that's seen all over. And during that time, that we detonated 67 tests. But to put that in perspective, that was the equivalent, those 67 tests, of about 1.5 Hiroshima-sized bombs daily for 12 years. Daily. So that's a huge effect.
Well, let me stop you there just for a second. We'll come back to the lawsuit. But I've always wondered, how is it that anybody's alive there on the Marshall Islands? I mean, is it just that they've reproduced now for two or three generations, that there are just huge levels of cancer, or was it that the prevailing winds carried the fallout away from them, or what?
It's probably a combination therein. The Marshall Islands to this day are still feeling, you know, major health effects and environmental effects of those nuclear blasts.
Mm-hmm.
So it's probably a dilution effect and a multiplicity therein, but yet they still are affecting those every single day.
So were they encouraged to file these two lawsuits by activist groups, or what? Do you know the story behind this?
Yes. Well, you know, the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation has been an advising group to the Marshall Islands and for this case for the last couple of years. From the standpoint they stepped forward, it's been felt long time that these weapons are illegal and immoral, and while searching and working with, they stepped forward as a plaintiff after the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation was actually able to assemble a blue ribbon panel of international pro bono attorneys on international law.
Mm-hmm. So the fact that they've filed one with the International Court of Justice and one in a U.S. federal district court, does that mean they've also filed them in the other eight nuclear nations courts, federal national courts?
Primarily, it's been in the International Court of Justice type of thing, which, again, interestingly, you know, the United States has not recognized, even though we're signatory to that, for fear that we would be called on the carpet for our actions around the world.
Right.
And so it was decided that for the United States to come directly to our U.S. District Court in San Francisco. So it's very interesting. In the other states, there have been some suits filed, actually individually in the countries, but the other states or nations, if you will, recognize the International Court of Justice.
I see. Mm-hmm. So they're under that more than we are, yeah. So is part of their argument that these nine nuclear states are not actively negotiating good faith to get rid of all nuclear weapons, but are also continually upgrading and keeping the game going?
Exactly.
Because I don't think people understand that.
There is no obvious evidence that we're working in any measure in a, quote, good faith, end quote, measure to reduce these weapons.
Right.
It is estimated the Congressional Budget Office this past quarter came out and said that the United States will spend approximately $350 billion to modernize, not just to sustain, but to modernize our weapon systems over the next decade, $350 billion. And it's felt that that will amount to about $1 trillion in upgrades over the next 30 years. Russia is doing a very similar expenditure, as is China type of thing. So it's this continued aspect of building and building and building.
Right. Yeah, that's what I think people don't understand. They might think, oh, the few that are left are kind of mothballed, or but it's continually being revved up and ready to go. What about non-state parties that might be able to make some kind of device, nuclear device?
Well, so this gets back to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. When it was signed 44 years ago, the quote-unquote grand bargain was that, okay, we, the non-nuclear states, will not pursue development of nuclear weapons if the nuclear states agree to disarm, okay, because obviously there wouldn't be a need. But because we've done so little, it is this whole process of continuing to move the arms race forward, et cetera, to continue expend, continue to rob the treasure of the world that could be put to so many other humanitarian needs to build these stockpiles, that they've sort of stepped up. And again, probably the biggest risk of getting these non-nuclear states to get small armaments and things like that is actually almost the overflow, if you will, from ours, and then particularly former Soviet states where nuclear weapons control of decommissioned warheads is not nearly as careful as ours in this country.
Right. Well, wasn't there a period where it wasn't controlled at all, and then we kind of dashed over there and said, oh, we'll help you secure?
Absolutely.
But there was a period where it could have been taken.
The landmark legislation in the United States is a bipartisan act years ago by the Senators Nunn and Lugar. It's called the Nunn-Lugar Cooperative Threat Reduction Act, which the whole focus was to fund and to, if you will, quarantine, isolate, and decommission old Soviet nukes, if you will, okay?
Uh-huh.
Well, in the infinite wisdom, everything from budget sequestration to just to conservative politics, they've decided to markedly underfund and defund that stabilization program, which really stands as one way of guaranteeing our security to decommission those weapons.
Yeah. Wow. Why can't the case be made that that should not have been defunded? I mean, I don't understand, you know, the silence on the issue. I guess it's just that the groups who are saying it can't get into the national media, or what?
Well, I think it's multifactorial. I think that, first of all, with the crazy, you know, sequestration thing that we experienced this past year, where, again, it was going to be an across-the-board, it didn't matter what, whether it was food stamps or health care or...
Yeah.
Everybody was going to take an equal hit, so there was that. But we've worked since the beginning of the Cold War under the mythology of deterrence, okay? And so, if the pro-military, pro-nuclear lobby says, okay, well, I mean, we need to just keep building more weapons, okay, this reduction of weapons or whatever. No, we need to modernize and build a better nuke, a better mousetrap, et cetera. So it's a very difficult mindset to deal with.
Yeah, but how can they argue that we need 17, well, that's worldwide. How many do we have in this country?
We have about 7,500.
And well, how can they argue that we need 7,500 nuclear weapons?
Yes. Well, that's the perfect point and things, and that's, you know, which is so obvious because I think it's a very interesting thing because I think what has happened, as so often has happened with the military, is the arms race has become a jobs program, okay? Well, you don't want the nuclear facility in my community, so we're going to keep funding it. Or I just happen to make nuclear triggers. I don't make the bomb. I just make the triggers, or I just make the launchers. So it's this continuation program, which was obviously never the intent.
They also might say what I heard a chair of one of the Armed Forces Committee in Congress say when someone came before him and was, I don't know what question he was asked, but he answered back to the committee, asked the committee, why do we have over 729,000 bases around the country, United States military bases, some covert? Why do we need over 729 bases around? What would we think of another country who had 729 military bases around the world? And the chair said, we can't reduce that number because that would be, you know, a reduction in our power posture. So, you know, the number has to do with our power posture. So it would probably give the same kind of response to why we need 7,500 nuclear weapons. But there have also been a couple scandals. I mean, talking about upgrading, the nuclear facility in, where is it, in Utah?
Yes.
Yeah, well, you know, one commanding officer was, you know, relieved for bad behavior, drunkenness or whatever it was, I can't remember, drugs. And
right.
Then that scandal of, they all helped each other cheat on the test because the test is too hard.
Yes.
You know, what about that? I mean, just, you know, human factors in charge of these systems.
Well, I think that that's immense. And actually, the location is Wyoming. And again,
Wyoming. Okay, thanks.
And so in that regard, as you say, I mean, there is tremendous pressures for these officers. And again, they have to provide an aura of perfection, et cetera. And my gosh, they hold the fate of the planet in their hands. So
yeah.
I think it's amazing. you have to understand that, you know, that potentially the use of 100 to 200 of the current weapons at one moment in time could ultimately come back and threaten the entire existence of the planet. Just 100 to 200 weapons, okay? And we have 17,000, okay? And then you say... So it's a, I mean, it's an insane process type of thing. So, you know, the terminology used to be mutually assured destruction.
Right.
And now it's gone from mad to sad, which is self-assured destruction.
Yeah.
If there was a unilateral attack and the other side decided not to respond, it would only be a matter of time until they too died because of the consequences of the unilateral attack.
Right. And what about this phrase that we hear, oh, well, a limited nuclear war could be waged here and there. I think you've looked into the medical health effects of deploying even what they call limited amounts of a nuclear weapon.
Yes. The international physician body, which is called the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, and in this country, the United States, it's called Physicians for Social Responsibility. This is an organization that, you know, won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1985 for their work on the health effects of nuclear isotopes, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And they came out in November, this past November, with a huge document, and it's called 2 billion at risk: the health effects of a limited nuclear war, and they have posited, if you will, the exchange between India and Pakistan of their nuclear arsenals, which amount to about 0.5%, 0.5% of the global arsenals. If that was unleashed, they have, through scientific studies with climatologists and climate change, et cetera, and the effects therein, identified that approximately 2 billion people on the planet would perish from that limited 0.5% exchange. It's horrendous. There is no such thing as a limited exchange there that's survivable.
Mm-hmm. And did they use that example? Because I remember about, 5 or 8 years ago, there was talk there about, oh, well, you know, we'll just send off a small nuclear weapon into our neighbors. And there was talk reflecting the fact they didn't seem to grasp the nature of the weapons. Do you remember
that
situation?
When global security, from the CIA to the military on, they say, where are the hot spots that you're likely to see a potential nuclear conflict? It is India, Pakistan there. And so this awareness of just what that impact would be was studied. And these are the results. Again, 2 billion people at risk.
Can you give the website for where that report or a summary of it could be found?
Sure.
Is it the international?
PSR.org, and just look under the nuclear famine piece.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
Oh, nuclear famine, yet another
nuclear famine
wrinkle. I see. So it's not only the immediate health hits, but then over time the land cannot produce.
So what happens, just to continue, what happens if with that attack, that very small, is basically the surface temperature of the planet would drop, again, approximately 1.3 degrees, and that would cause devastating effects longitudinally over the central growing agricultural areas around
us. Is that because of what they used to call nuclear winter?
Yes. Uh-huh.
It would block, yeah.
This
okay.
is, again, and that was using a full scale all out, and this is a much smaller. The science has moved much more clearly and definitively. So even with a small attack, it's amazing. And what it would, you know, it releases this massive carbon aerosol, black carbon aerosol across the planet, and that's what changes the growing seasons.
Okay. Well, we're going to pause here for the break, and then we'll be back. this is Charlene Spretnak on All Together Now, speaking with my guest, Robert Dodge, of Physicians for Social Responsibility.
Let's give them something to talk about, babe. A little mystery to figure out.
Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spratnak speaking with my guest, Robert Dodge of Physicians for Social Responsibility. So, Robert, could you tell us about this conference last year that the Norwegian government convened? It was a gathering of 129 nations in Oslo for 2 days, and it was a conference on the humanitarian consequences of nuclear war. And as I understand it, the United States and the four other permanent members of the UN Security Council boycotted the meeting. So what was all that about, and were you involved?
I was involved just from the standpoint that PSR and the IPPNW, the International Physicians, were part of the sponsors of the conference. It was a huge conference, and again, most of the signatories of the Non-Proliferation Treaty and the global community were there, with the glaring absence of the P5, the permanent five of the Security Committee, who do have the nuclear weapons. And they had varying excuses as their involvement would potentially interfere with their, quote, good faith attempts, end quote, to reduce nuclear stockpiles. It was really quite glaring. The conference focused on much of what we've discussed in the early part of the interview here in terms of humanitarian consequences of the health effects, the non-survivability of nuclear attack, et cetera. And it was actually and came out with, again, a solidarity, if you will, of the rest of the world to pressure the P5 to move toward disarmament. There was a follow-up conference in Mexico a couple of months ago, again, with a similar outcome of players, the P5 again absent. But this is an ongoing effort that is major and is building a groundswell around the world.
Well, there seemed to be remarkably little, if any, coverage in the United States of that. I mean, it seems like planetary events where we're not at the center, although we probably were driving the boycott from the center, don't get covered. I mean, I realize it's because of corporate ownership of the media, but supposedly, you know, through the internet, everything's getting covered now. But in the same way that local news used to and maybe still does kind of just have a hole where state government coverage should be, nationally, it seems like there's not a place for planetary events that may or may not, you know, have your country as a starring role. That was a planetary event when they call that many nations together and they come to this resolution. And, you know, our purpose is to push these five to do more to disarm. It just seems, I don't know, I won't say dismaying, we don't want to get depressed, but disappointing that it didn't seem to register or get put out here in terms of information.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, the coverage in this country has been largely through alternative media and the organizations that are supporting this whole movement. Groups like yourself, like Common Dreams, again, like PSR, who has a huge web following. There's, you know, in this country and around the world, there's and it's called the Campaign for a Nuclear Weapons Free World. And this is a coalition of large global movements. So this is wherein the coverage is happening. I was intrigued because 2 weeks ago when the nuclear lawsuits were brought out and brought forth type of thing, within 12 hours, there were 2.5 million hits globally on social media. So, and that was within 12 hours. So, I mean, I think this is, again, going to be a major incentive to keep this moving forward again. And interesting enough, in this case, the United States and each of the countries being sued has to respond, even whether they support or not support the International Court of Justice. They have to, by law, respond. They can't just blow it off. And certainly, could you imagine if we decided, the United States, said, we're not going to respond to breach of international treaty? What does that say about any treaty that we're signatory to? So I think this may push the envelope, if you will, and that's certainly the hope herein.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, the language is, I'm sure it had to be vague in order to get it passed in the 1970 Non-Proliferation Treaty, but to say there negotiating in good faith, they could say, you know, we have these ongoing discussions, you know, it's just foremost on our minds. It seems like there's a lot of wiggle room there.
Well, again, you know, it's interesting. I think that's the wiggle room is probably the excuse we have used, but the reality is it's very clear, and we at this country know very well. This week ends the two-week non-proliferation treaty prep conference at the United Nations, and I get several times a day updates on that. I participated in the 2010 conference and probably will participate next year at the 2015. That conference at the United Nations in New York is mandated by the treaty that happened every 5 years. But in between, there was such movement in 2010 that they said, we're going to hold preparatory conferences for the big one in 2015 every year. So there have been ongoing yearly conferences there. So, and again, having been there, it was very impressive because, as you say, and the United States, you know, State Department is there in big force. You get a real opportunity to speak to them and sort of call them on the carpet.
What is the focus of those conferences? Is it how to get this into the political agenda of the nuclear countries that aren't doing anything? Or, I mean, how do we close the gap between all these hits on social media and policy?
Right. Well, so again, so the purpose of the conference is to realize and meet the demand and the letter of the non-proliferation treaty. And again, in particular, it's the Article 6, which is the one calling for the complete and total and verifiable disarmament. So they have all these sidebar discussions about holding it accountable. This year, again, there was once again a major move by the Asian states to have an Asia nuclear-free zone type of thing, et cetera. Hmm. There's been one for South America. So they build these coalitions. And basically, it keeps it in the forefront, if you will, as we try to continue to educate, okay?
Wow, that would be interesting if they could get those big nuclear-free zones. Do you think there's a possibility of that?
I think there's always a possibility there. And again, and they're very concerned, et cetera, you know, the states in Asia type. So, yes, I think that's a very real possibility. Other things that have come out in the last 2 weeks, the New Zealand Labor Party is supporting and thinking of joining the Marshall Islands lawsuit, et cetera. So, I mean, there's been lots of very interesting coming out of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I would like to hear about this related project. It's a collaborative project between Physicians for Social Responsibility and Rotary International, a peace project.
Sure. Well, yeah, and it's actually been remarkable. I've been working with them over this past year. So it's Rotary International and, again, the International Physicians. You know, it's interesting. Rotary, first of all, is a wonderful service organization that really has chapters around the world, from Vietnam to Russia to the United States, et cetera. So they have chapters and groups all around. And, you know, their current global effort for many years has been the eradication of polio. And Rotary works as a very much ground up organization. It's not a top down, it's a ground up. So when the various chapters say, yep, that's a project we wanted to do and want to work on, such as eradication of polio, well, they've taken it on. And they've done a very good job, interestingly enough, through no fault of their own, until this very recent past year or so, which, very interestingly, war has been the downside. The wars in Syria, Afghanistan. This last week, there was a major World Health Organization report saying that there had been over 400 outbreaks of polio in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Cameroon, et cetera, due to war and conflict. Well,
I thought it was
said,
Bob, I thought it was a matter of their thinking that any foreign health inoculators coming into villages are really spies. It wasn't only war, it was distrust of these outsiders with the immunization.
It's actually a both and. the process, too, through some significant botches in international policy. Like when we went in to vote for Osama bin Laden, we had these false kind of polio inoculators that really weren't there, just trying to get information. So that broke down trust, et cetera. And again, but there have been many of fear of the program, but also just when there's poverty and war and water supplies are broken and again, and other individuals coming across state lines, this is where we're seeing these outbreaks of
yeah.
polio.
Yeah.
So it's, again, but war is absolutely the instigating, and conflict has been the instigating feeder herein.
Uh-huh.
So my point was going to be that, again, so Rotary International is very much in a position, it says, you know, they're looking for brotherhood, and if you read their mission statement, there's a lot about peace and getting along and resolving issues of food supply and children's health, et cetera. Well, so interesting, and they actually, they've had for several years now, if you look up Rotary War Prevention, there's been a discussion in the grassroots and up and down Rotary about maybe the eradication of war should be the post-polio project that Rotary is positioned to do.
Uh-huh.
But we've been working with them from PSR, the Physicians Movement, on this new health implications of nuclear war. And so it's been a collaborative effort. So now they have they are working with us in terms of a speakers bureau internationally. We have probably 100 physicians internationally that will be going out and speaking at Rotary clubs on the health implications of nuclear war, sort of the non-survivability, and encouraging Rotarians to develop, if you will, peace clubs or peace chapters at each of their clubs, and they can actually already do it through their they can go on through their Rotary site and just actually develop a peace chapter in each individual club. So it's a very, very exciting prospect moving forward.
Wow. Well, I just want to say for any listeners who are too young to remember this, during the peace movement of the early 1980s, when there were 50,000 active nuclear warheads, as I say, we had 30,000 pointed toward the Soviet Union. They had 20,000 pointed toward us. At that time, when there was, you know, huge grassroots effort to get rid of those nuclear weapons, it was, to the surprise of us in grassroots peace movement groups, Rotary International, who stepped up to the plate. I mean, heretofore, I wasn't familiar with them, but they seemed to me just, you know, a business group, a local business group, like, you know, the Chamber of Commerce or something. And they made that peace project their major focus. That one of their presidents that year sort of set the course, and they really contributed quite a lot internationally to the peace movement in the early 80s. So I'm not surprised, but I'm very impressed with what you say they're doing now.
Yes, no, it's remarkable. And so what we're working together. We have resources, educational materials, parts of the website, and we're working to build that groundswell of grassroots support. Because, you know, the interesting thing is, obviously, all of us know all wars end. They all end eventually. And so the whole process now is they end through some sort of a negotiated settlement. The process here is to move towards war prevention. Let's deal with those issues before we go to war and start losing all of the young people of your country, my country, et cetera. And those negotiating skills, those abilities, those platforms, they exist today. And this is really what it's doing about, is resolving conflict without war.
Yeah. I think that is so important, and it is, as you say, you know, to avoid the loss of lives of young people, but it just, the cost of war on every level just ripple out for decades, setting a society back. And I think a really interesting organization to bring in, even to testify, would be the organization that started up to work only in post-war zones. It's Women to Women International. And they go in to countries that have had recent civil wars or other kinds of wars where, you know, everything's devastated. The farmland, the fruit trees have been cut down. It's like a scorched earth. The men have been killed. The women have been raped. How to put this together? And they start with all kinds of programs, you know, to rebuild among the survivors. So what they have seen about the effects of war, because they focus solely on post-war zones is, I think it would be very useful for this to get people's attention to why, as you say, we need to eliminate this, you know, jump into war.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And another international agency, which people are often unaware, but in the last couple of years, the International Red Cross, the international, not the American, but the International Red Cross has called for an abolition to nuclear weapons and to war also. So it's very interesting because obviously they come
right.
in the conflict. So.
Yeah. Well, let me double back to where I started at the beginning of the hour, which is on climate change, because you've also looked into and done some writing on the health effects of global climate disruption. So could you tell us about that?
Yes, and again, a couple of things I'll just show. They're all related. That's what the rest of my work, it's all related. Because as climate changes, again, whether it's in sub-Saharan Africa, where you're seeing increasing drought and loss of crops, et cetera, you're seeing increasing conflict. And when we don't have tools to resolve conflict short of killing each other, war resolves, okay?
Right.
And if war gets pushed to the nth, nuclear weapons are always brought up of all possibilities are on the table. So there's a connection there. But some of the biggest areas with climate change we're seeing, as we continue to warm the planet, we're seeing heat-related illnesses, everything from dehydration with associated arrhythmias. I mean, in this country, in the recent decade, when we've had so many heat waves in New York City, we've had thousands dying in our country alone just from heat-related illnesses.
Yeah.
This typically affects the very young, infants, and the very old. So heat waves, we're seeing extreme weather events, you know, whether that's huge monsoons or storms, et cetera, rising sea levels cause all sorts of areas and problems of water damage and drownings. Just, for example, Hurricane Sandy in this country, et cetera, Hurricane Katrina type thing, causing major areas. Air pollution that's resulting from climate change, both resulting with and source cause of, is causing ozone changes, which are increasing cardiovascular diseases, both from arrhythmias to what we call cardiomyopathies. Coal-fired power plants are causing dramatic increases in childhood asthma, particularly in the Northeast type of thing. In areas, again, coming back to the African continent, as we see continued warming, we see vector-borne diseases from insects. The longer, hotter, drier seasons cause increased mosquitoes, et cetera, and mosquito bites and all the diseases they carry. The World Health Organization estimates that 600,000 people died from malaria in 2010 alone. 600,000 people, and
mm-hmm.
that's on the increase.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're seeing major, major, and then the final, which also ties in, it's interesting, as we heat the planet or cool the planet, you know, the planet is very much like you and I. We do best about 98.6. If we raise our temperature just a couple of degrees for an extended period of time, that has detrimental and deadly health effects. You can't live at 101 for, you know, continue. You will die at that point.
Right.
So the planet, which is our biosystem, needs that very tight controlled weather system. And again, so when it goes
right.
up or down, we destroy crops. We lose
right.
about 10% crops for every 1 degree elevation and 10% or more for every degree drop. So it's a very fine, you know, homeostatic.
We're out of time, Robert. But I am totally behind getting this information out, and I want to thank you so much, Robert Dodge, for coming on the program.
It's been my absolute pleasure. I thank you so much, and we can do it.
Right, okay. Well, let's amble over to the Arts Corner now, and our poem on this lovely day in May, no matter what may happen in the future, well, it simply must be a few stanzas from the May Magnificat by Gerard Manley Hopkins. This poem was written in England in the 1880s. By a man who converted to Catholicism and became a Jesuit. And here he's wondering why May is associated as being the month of Mary. Flesh and fleece, fur and feather, grass and green world, all together. Star-eyed, strawberry-breasted throstle above her nested cluster of bugle-blue eggs thin. Forms and warms the life within, and bird and blossom swell in sod or sheath or shell. All things rising, all things sizing, Mary sees, sympathizing with that world of good, nature's motherhood. For our song this week, we'll hear a musical expression of the bursting forth of springtime energies. From Vivaldi's Four Seasons, this is the first movement of Spring, performed by the English Chamber Orchestra. Here it is. That was the first movement of Spring from Vivaldi's Four Seasons. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. If you'd like to see who my guests will be for the next few weeks, go to my website, charlenespretnak.com, and click on the tab that says Radio. Next week, my co-host, Eleanor LeCain, will be here with her guest. I'll be back 2 weeks from today on May 22nd. Thanks for joining us. This is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now. Now that we know it, let's